Welcome to Veterinary Vertex, a podcast of the AVMA journals. I'm Editor-in-Chief, Dr. Lisa Fortier, and I'm joined by Social Media Editor, Dr. Sarah Wright.
We're bringing you a special episode with our guest, Dr. Janet Grimes. Janet, we are so excited to speak with you today. Janet is an Associate Professor of Small Animal Surgery at the University of Georgia College of Veterinary Medicine. In this episode, we're going to talk about Janet's manuscript, Evaluation of the Validity of the Double Two-Thirds Rule for Diagnosing Hemangiosarcoma in Dogs with Non-Traumatic Hemoperitoneum Due to a Ruptured Splenic Mass, a Systematic Review. Dr. Grimes, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to chat with y'all today.
Great, let's dive right in. Hemangiosarcoma is a devastating cancer that many veterinarians have diagnosed. I remember during my small animal rotating internship, we were taught to use the double two-thirds rule when discussing prognosis and treatment options with clients. What new information can our readers learn from your manuscript to better serve their patients and their clients?
Similar to your experience, I also remember using this rule very heavily in my internship year. And it wasn't really until we decided to do this paper that I realized that the original rule applied to all splenic masses and not just those associated with hemoperitoneum. And so the original citation comes from one of our oncology textbooks, and it cites four papers that contain information on almost 2,200 dogs with splenic lesions, but only 100 of those dogs had information on whether or not they had a hemoperitoneum. So when Cleveland and Casal published in JAVMA in 2016 about incidentally found splenic masses having a 70-30 chance of being benign, it really made me wonder if the numbers for the double two-thirds rule would change when we only looked at dogs with hemoperitoneum. And so what we found in our study is that 73% of dogs with non-traumatic hemoperitoneum due to a splenic mass have a malignant lesion, and of those, 87% had hemangiosarcoma. So compared to the double two-thirds rule, the chances were actually worse of having both a malignancy and hemangiosarcoma. And I personally had wondered about the second part of the double two-thirds rule because I do feel that hemangiosarcoma is so prevalent amongst the malignancies. But I still think it's a useful rule, and it's certainly easy to remember. But in reality, the odds may be more stacked against those patients than we previously thought when hemoperitoneum is present.
I'm so glad that you guys did this study and that you published it in JAVMA so that our readers can learn about that, because that's huge. I mean, that's really going to be potentially a game changer, especially when talking to clients, so that they can have the tools to make an informed decision about what they want to do with their pet's care moving forward. So thank you so much for sharing that with JAVMA.
Sure.
So what are common misconceptions about hemangiosarcoma? And what is the role of the veterinarian in addressing these misconceptions and educating their clients and the general public?
So hemangiosarcoma is a very aggressive tumor, and unfortunately survival remains poor even with surgery and chemotherapy. And so that being said, I don't know that there's too many misconceptions about this tumor. It's really a bad one. However, I do think there are a lot of misconceptions about splenic masses in general. And so the biggest struggle I have with these is that you have this population of dogs that have hemangiosarcoma, undeniably a bad tumor to have. But on the flip side, a large portion of the remaining dogs will have a splenic hematoma, which can be cured with surgery. And I don't really like to use the word cure too often, but in this case, it's definitely true. And that's what really makes this decision to proceed with surgery or euthanasia so gut-wrenching for these owners. You're left with either a significant emotional and financial investment with the outcome options of either a complete cure or a short-term survival. Or alternatively, if the decision is euthanasia, that comes with the possibility of regret if a benign lesion is later diagnosed on necropsy. And so it's just a huge conundrum for veterinarians and their clients. And so it's really important to be as accurate as possible. And so I think this paper helps to clarify that with hemoperitoneum, the chances of a malignancy and specifically hemangiosarcoma are worse than we previously thought. But diagnosis of a benign lesion isn't impossible. And so ideally, we would have a sensitive and specific test that can help us diagnose the nature of a splenic mass prior to surgery. But until such a time as that test exists, all we can really do is provide an informed best guess. And so I think it's up to the attending veterinarian to help guide their client in the best way they can by providing all of the information. It doesn't make the decision any easier, but that's really all that we have right now.
Yeah, it's really, really important information, Janet. I, I really admire you for taking the moment and thinking, huh, and going back to the original, like, you know, so many things were taught and nobody goes back to the original manuscript to say, what was that really about? Are we still interpreting that correctly? And as you know, a lot of things that are in textbooks, they aren't necessarily, they aren't peer reviewed, right? So a lot of that stuff just becomes eminence based, and good for you and your team for really stopping and taking a second look at things.
Yeah. Thank you.
The other thing I'd like to hear from you about is, at least in my opinion, systematic reviews are not performed as often as they could. And I even think should be in veterinary medicine. I'm even guilty of that. Sometimes there's not enough manuscripts to do a systematic review, but they're really difficult to do. And I'd like to know what inspired you to write this and how can you help other authors that might be listening on what the importance is of a systematic review?
Yeah, so one of my main research passions is hemangiosarcoma. So I'm always thinking about this tumor and, you know, I have a lot of other studies going on. I do some molecular work. And so I try to prospectively enroll these cases. And it's very difficult to get case numbers. And so I think the benefit of a systematic review is you can kind of use what other people have put out there. So, you know, as a sole institution, you may not be able to really provide that many new cases to the literature. But if you can take what's already in the literature and kind of combine that to answer your research question, you can get a pretty large number of cases very quickly. This was my first systematic review, and it was definitely a process. So there's a whole world out there for systematic reviews that I previously didn't really know about. So the PRISMA statement and guidelines. And so I kind of went onto their website to figure out, you know, what do I need to do this? And luckily, they have very well-written, well-thought-out guidelines with lots of examples so you can kind of apply it to your specific study. And so we just kind of went through their steps one by one by one, and it's really helpful to make sure you don't forget anything. I think one of the things I found with this was, you know, in veterinary medicine, we really need more larger studies with better quality evidence to really answer the questions that we're asking. And so to me, probably the biggest thing that stood out about the systematic review was kind of assessing the evidence of the papers that we have out there. And so unfortunately, most of the papers had pretty low quality evidence. And so that's going to be our retrospective case series. And so, you know, and I'm guilty of publishing several of those as well. And so I think it really kind of emphasized to me how much we need more of these randomized controlled clinical trials and other high quality evidence studies in the literature. And so systematic reviews, I think, help kind of put that all together, help the reader understand, you know, we have all these cases, but how much can we trust what these are telling us? Another thing we found with the study, so the study period with the systematic review was actually 115 years, which is a really long time. And in that time, we only found 14 studies that we could include. And so a lot of this was because the study maybe just didn't report if the dogs had hemoperitoneum or not. And so I think, you know, we've come a long way in the last 50 at least of those 100 years, but we definitely have a lot more work to do to get our literature to be higher quality.
Yeah, I'm guilty of some of the retrospectives and smaller case series and all of those things too. It's just really hard. You know, Sarah and I and all of JABMA and AJVR, as you said, we need more original prospective randomized clinical trials. And, you know, we put those open access and waive the open access fees, not just to get the information out there, but really for all the things that you're saying, we need to promote and reward people for doing those really difficult studies. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So you're obviously a clinician and a scientist and really forward thinking in your writing as an author too. What couple life lessons would you give to others who are trying to emulate your success?
So this is a really tough question. I would say, I think, working hard and staying curious is really important. Without curiosity, science really isn't going to move forward, but it also takes a lot of hard work and persistence to make that curiosity pay off. And I also think it's important to cultivate relationships. So throughout veterinary school, internship, and residency, I've had the opportunity to meet and work with so many different people. And many of them have played a huge role in helping me to become the veterinarian and researcher that I am today. And I've also been really fortunate to have a great team of people around me at the University of Georgia. And they've really supported me and helped me grow as a faculty member. And I think without this team of people, I really wouldn't be able to accomplish what I've accomplished this far. So I think all of those are really important.
It's definitely important to find your people in veterinary medicine because, like you said, they lift you up, and especially during the hard days or when a case doesn't go the way you want to, it's important to have them in your corner.
Absolutely.
You are currently an associate professor of small animal surgery at the University of Georgia. How has this position changed your perspective on One Health?
So I think this is a great question because One Health is just so important. And working in academia and specifically at the University of Georgia, I have access to so many resources. And so when I collaborate with researchers studying human conditions, they consistently tell me how jealous they are of us working in veterinary medicine because we see patients with naturally occurring disease. And the answers gleaned from further study on these veterinary patients are so helpful to both veterinary and human patients alike. And so many of us here collaborate with researchers in other disciplines, such as like engineering, genomics, and metabolomics. And in that, we are helping them to develop techniques, devices, or diagnostics for human conditions. But many of these also apply directly to our veterinary patients, providing an immediate benefit to all of us. And specifically within oncology, I think, you know, the environmental effects leading to cancer development are sometimes similar in our veterinary patients and in humans. And so that helps tie the importance of environment into the One Health mission. And so the University of Georgia has just really been so encouraging of collaboration across departments and colleges. And there's always opportunities to work across disciplines to further both human and animal health. And so I think working here has only strengthened my perspective that the One Health mission is really critical to the success of medicine, regardless of the species.
It's great to hear about that cross-discipline collaboration. I think we're hearing more and more of that. I think it's excellent because, like you said, it's how we're going to advance medicine, no matter what species you're treating. So your work brings a lot of important points to the table, but what is the clinical take-home message that you would like veterinarians to know?
I think the main take-home message for this paper was that dogs with non-traumatic hemoperitoneum, there's a higher chance of malignancy and hemangiosarcoma specifically. But I think it's also important to remember that the prognosis for dogs without non-traumatic hemoperitoneum is better than we may have thought, as shown by that Cleveland paper. And so you can't assume that all dogs with splenic masses have hemangiosarcoma. And I think the other thing, you know, that's really a take-home for this is we need to look into this more. You know, this isn't the end. We need to keep digging into this, doing additional studies and trying really to figure out how do we make this tumor better.
Yeah, thank you, Janet. What Janet was talking about earlier, I want to talk about the PRISM guidelines. You can find those in our instructions for authors. Obviously, we love to get systematic reviews as well. So we have that's in our instructions for authors. And I can explain a little bit more about what Janet is referring to. Thanks again, Janet. I learned a ton. And as we come close to wrapping up, I think you're inspiring. So thank you for all the work that you're doing. We'd like to ask something just a little bit more personal when we wrap up. So what is the most interesting or the oldest item in Janet Grimes' desk drawer today?
So that's a good question. I think those who know me would not be surprised to hear that I have a no button on my desk that I've had for years. So I can, you know, push that and give out a shout no whenever I am feeling the need. But I tend not to say no to a lot of research opportunities. So that gets me into trouble sometimes. And I think other than that, probably one of the most important things I keep in my drawer, one of the things I treasure the most are thank you notes from clients and then students and house officers that I've taught along the way. So whenever I'm having a bad day, I can pull those out and they're really a great reminder of why I do what I do and that what I do means something. It's because sometimes it's easy to forget that. So it's really great to have reminders close by.
Yeah, very true. When you push your button, does it say no or do you buzzer and say, do you say no or does the button?
it says no in very different ways. So sometimes it shouts, sometimes it's no, you know, it just goes on for a while. And so every time you push it, it's a little bit different. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Right, that's amazing. Does that stay on your desk or do you ever bring that to rounds or anything?
No, it stays on my desk. I think bringing it to rounds might be a good idea for sure. But, you know, unfortunately for, you know, if another group walks into the clinic and they have an emergency foreign body or something that needs to go, you can't really say no. So it's better probably to leave it in the office.
That's true. Well, thank you so much again. We really appreciate your time and just sharing everything with us about your manuscript.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for the opportunity to talk about it a little bit more.
Of course. You can read Dr. Grimes' manuscript in JAPMA on our journal website. I'm Dr. Sarah Wright with Dr. Lisa Fortier. We want to thank each of you for joining us on this episode of the Veterinary Vertex podcast. We love sharing cutting-edge research with you. We want to hear from you. Be sure to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you listen to.
Until next time, take care and we'll see you soon.